temperature is called for at the time was 137. It's April 4th, 2016. We do have a quorum present to hear business, consisting of myself, Senator Lisa McGuire, my vice chair, Senator Tom Hunko, Senator Leah Costello, and Senator Bill Wilkowski. We have three items on the agenda today that have been noticed. I'll take them up in this order. The first is Senate Joint Resolution Number 12. A Senate Joint Resolution pertaining to a constitutional amendment regarding an elected Attorney General by Senator Schultz. They will go to Senate Bill Number 164 by the Governor, request of the Department of Fish and Game, and we do have the reference to Representative Blackwell. And then finally, Senate Bill Number 108, also by the Governor, pertaining to the Alaska Securities Act. So with that, we'll go ahead and run forward to Senate Joint Resolution Number 12. We do have the bill sponsor and the bill sponsor's staff, if you'd like. To yourself an answer, just push yourself in the record and tell us about it.
Okay, Madam Postal Secretary's have Northern Communities, we know the Anchorage, Chugiak, Chug Lazy Mountain, Colorado, Wassello, the Gaming Guides Country. It's a great pleasure to be here today to present Senator Clinton Resolution 12. I don't know if it's my bill, but it's a people's bill. It was sponsored by all political factions, liberal, conservative, Democrat, Republican over the years. The first common thread is a belief that Attorney General Howard, of course, still speaks to the people of Alaska, enforces the Constitution on behalf of the people of Alaska. Simple as that. I wonder, before I start, so this is not a reflection on any individual Attorney General, past, current, or past or current Attorney General, or hopefully, with the grace of the people. But it is really a systemic change. I think the people of Alaska will embrace the opportunity to vote on their general election. It's been done many times over the years in all kinds of iterations of the sponsorship. For about 75% of you sitting here, this is something you're probably familiar with within the last week. Three of the members are from the state of Pennsylvania. Former Representative Costello appeared at least a couple of times as a member of the House Finance Committee, and the only rules are about finance committees where you are finance. It's not an unfamiliar subject. It's a very heavily weighted issue because we are talking about changing the Constitution. It's a pretty simple concept. There's certainly arguments for it, that's a part of the spirit of your questions and discussion in a political way as well. But for me, it's having people of Alaska have an individual that is nothing but undivided attention of enforcing the Constitution on behalf of the people of Alaska, only serving one master, and that is the people of Alaska who would choose them to represent them. There's certainly arguments against them. I don't know about a political position. He has a political position right now, and it's the governor's lawyer. There's nothing nefarious about that, but the can't legal that these things are law school graduates, so you serve your client. That has been the history of the Attorney General. They serve the client. I'm just going to find three one brief section. It's a comment by the President of the Pastors of the Nation, a quote from 1955, Madam Chair.
Yes.
This is reported by the Foreign Exchange Inquiry on November 7, 1955. And this is a quoting teacher governor. Billy was a senator from Calgary, the territorial senate, serving as the presiding officer of the Constitutional Convention and the actual office of the Alphabet. On the issue of how many elective offices that there should be, besides the legislature, there's a tendency toward agreement on there being only a few. If there would be the governor, of course, and presumably the lieutenant governor, then called the Secretary of State, which was changed in 1970, I believe, by one or so. My friend, though, that most did not mention much of an office. William E. Duncombe is a Democrat leader in the Territorial Senate, summarized the case this way. This is Senator Eden's quote. I'm in favor of a strong executive branch of government in order that the people might never be able to place the finger of responsibility without court passing. There should be a minimum of other elected officials. One office I feel that should most certainly remain elected, and my quite frankly, the former government candidate was elected to a territorial form of government, is that of State Attorney General. It would seem to me that this would provide a safeguard as a strong chief executive usurping the powers of the office. And as a classic Governor Reagan, now over 60 years ago, and as a leader of the Constitutional Commission, there's really one in that delegate's opinion, and as we know, it wasn't the prevailing opinion. I can talk to many of us have had conversations in the past, that we decided that it would go to remain. Former senator of the Senate, former lieutenant governor, and Dan Connell, and former senator, territorial legislator, and Senator Mike Fisher. I remember having a conversation with Hill Belcher when he visited here. It is Patrick Wilson, said another person who heard of him anymore. And his annual visit night, I asked him, a group of us younger people around him, this must have been in their 80s. And so he made a mistake of saying these were the people who wrote the Constitution. He goes, I didn't write the Constitution. It was a bunch of damn lawyers who did. Individual. He was a Democrat from Homer during that term vote, and he was a senator during the first part of statement. And there was a prominence of lawyers who turned out that were good or bad. I think irrespective of the Constitution, this is one area that I think we've gone through now over 50 years of statehood, and we're going to survive, but I think it would be stronger. I think the people would be better served if they had a chief law enforcement officer that worked for the people. And this is not for a political party, not for an executive. Not providing legal advice. The governor needs legal advice. So I know it's recently was a gas administration for a government party. All of that is probably his primary counsel, another former informal one, Sonny Navarro, that he relied on others from Democrat, but that's who assisted him. And so rather informally, I think when he needed advice from him as acting as a chief executive branch, it was probably better that he got advice rather than from the Attorney General, who had might have divergent opinions, but if you look down to serious point, I think the governor deserves to have the ability to have legal counsel, and he certainly does staff the ability to make sure that he has that type of an individual on staff. It should not be the people's lawyer providing legal advice to the governor's appointments. I believe that being shared by many, again, it's not unlike that. There's been no vote that was suggested that there's ever been wrongdoing or anything nefarious. But I think this provides a stronger system without, it just doesn't compromise the role of the people. It should be the people's attorney. And really, I think, Madam Chair, that is really the essence. It's made in the Constitution. As required by the Constitution, you can only go before the voters during the general election passing in 1872. As people are approved with governor's apology on decisions, they turn down many of the proposals that the legislature has proposed. And all the regulations, legislative membership, the confirmation of some of the public corporations. The people have rubber stamped what the legislature has suggested they might want to vote on, so they're thinking about doing a vote on it. They've Immigration is a role of all of the ones that are victims' rights. Those that get some folks may think 90 days is too long, or there was a year when there was no termination date on the left and the left's exception. Only after a lot of political information that got to the voters and it passed overwhelming as well. This is a similar issue. I think the voters, they were not presupposed what the voters would do, but I just put them in the interaction time with the public. I think they would like to have an attorney there that worked for them exclusively. And typically that concludes my remarks, and certainly the bill from questions. There certainly is a subjective nature of the proposal, but I think it also reflects what's important for policy change that for many years it has been recognized on both sides of the aisle through the existence of the benefit of the people's process, but it's never been through the legislative process.
Thank you, Senator Saltz. I was just looking at the chart that was provided in our packets showing current governors and their attorney generals, and then the mechanism of selection. And just for the record, I think this is something we can say would work on this bill. It should be a part of it, showing that of all of the 50 states, then only five have appointed by governor. One does appointment or election by the legislature, and one is election by the Supreme Court. But so seven total that are elected by the people. So that just shows you, in my opinion, it's one indication of how the trend is. Normally, not to say that how we do the worst that is always worse, but just to highlight how other places do it. And the thing that I noticed when we were in the Senate State Affairs and Minnesota again today, in the cases where the governor appoints on the subject of politicizing the Attorney General, in all cases, with the exception of Alaska, but we understood that nuance, and she was an independent versus Republican, in all cases, the Attorney General bears the same political party affiliation to the governor. And I think that's not by accident. I think that is what you see, where when you look at the states where the Attorney General is elected, you see a lot of mass nations. You see Republican governors or Democratic governors or Republican Attorney Generals and Democratic Attorney Generals. So just speaking to the point about whether or not they can politicize the Attorney General position, I just support your testimony that it is already by virtue of the fact that the office of governor is political. There's a political election that plays out, and once that election is resolved, then the power resides with that individual to select someone. So I just want to put those comments on the record, and just to say that I too believe that it's within the governor's power to appoint his or her own counsel. I have looked at an amendment to it. I think it's too confusing. I think it could be efficient through the process. It could be a part of the rare pamphlet to explain to people that the governor would not be left without his or her own counsel. But I've just seen over the years, both parties do it, different governors do it. I worry that we'll reach a point at some place where there isn't enough equitable space between the two, and not to have discouragement on our colleagues. I know he's doing a great job, and again, I know this isn't aimed at him, but I'm just worried in years past as the Attorney General really becomes the governor's appointed counsel, that they go increasingly more and more into areas that are controversial and are being played out more special interests associated with them. So, in support of the bill, I open up to members and state that Laura Bonner is the only person that I have on the record to testify. If there's support, I'd like to. It's a fairly simple, straightforward bill. With three of us are in Senate State Affairs, but if there is the ability to move out, I'd like to keep it moving. Now, defer to that committee on that, and then just open up for questions for Senator Saltz at this point.
Senator Saltz, I know you've had this before the legislature before, so could you just run through what some of the concerns have been and for the response to those.
Thank you, Ms. Senator. So, some of my concerns have been that the Constitution's part not broke. Don't fix it. It's a perfect document. Doesn't move past the legislators in the office. Those are the people who responded to those concerns. And some of them were not interviewed with respect to it. There are philosophical divisions in whether or not you think that the executive should have control over.
So if this were passed and they go before the voters and pass, then the Attorney General would be raising money and accepting contributions. And if that's the case, I mean, do you see any problem with that where people might want, particularly to see, you know, let's say there's something happening in the state of the time and they want to try to, you know, influence
the role of the outcomes of the home. Sure. I think there are interests from legal donors and campaign workers. I think the Attorney General's going to be seeing that reflected. I think our current Attorney General was certainly very politically active in the last campaigns I've heard. And I don't think it's an unusual circumstance. We've had Attorney General said that we're playing cooperative I don't think we've had some outstanding Attorney Generals. I think the argument that the best argument I've heard is you probably couldn't get a guy trying to call a run for office and I think you couldn't find some Attorney Generals. But on the balance, I think that we've had some outstanding people that we might not have gotten through. I think we've had two lessons from Dr. Jones, who I don't think the public would have supported, and I don't think that we've had any of us being attacked. It is a political situation. It has been a political situation in many circumstances.
It seems like it's a hard change for states to make. You know, we're used to it a certain way, and this week, you know, we have to go and change the Constitution. Both the states that do have an elected Attorney General, but those in place at the time of their state, or did they make those changes, you know, when their states now to the city?
Most Americans would be comfortable with that. But the abilities of Chris Christie, in a lot of circumstances, being the chief law enforcement officer was helpful for you. But I guess that was kind of determined, but I guess that's my feeling. There's no chance of me being governor unless I get a building collapse. I don't think they have a problem getting their private succession. But I think every governor likes to have consolidated power. As a citizen of Alaska and as a servant and representative for people at the local level and the state level, I think it's a better policy consideration and a people's wonder.
Senator Lukowski.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for asking the concerns of the colonization that we should make this position a nonpartisan one.
that's a budget consideration. I thought back and forth on that. Because it might be the end of my day, which is simply rather like it's a conservative company as your vote. But that, the number of candidates that have filed, every selection does serve a purpose of figuring out if you have one, two, or three candidates. But as a policy consideration, I don't know what I thought about it. Is to make that person ineligible to run for a statewide office for a period of a few years afterwards. I think that would probably accomplish more than something I've proposed in the past. I think that would probably resolve more of the problem of being a political stepping stone to the nature.
So,
what
have
you thought?
Well, I just had one final question. So, you had mentioned that you see this. Now that this resolution is putting forward the people's attorney general, and my question is, and I don't know, does the attorney general have even oath?
There are all cabinet officials taking oath, they also have some pretty strong covenants of, what do you call that, canons of ethics, serving their client as well, which is, I assume the constitutional oath should be the overriding one.
And there are ethics acts then that apply to the attorney general and the executive branch. Now, my assumption would be as an elected member, then the elected officials' ethics acts would then be applicable.
Thank you for bringing this up, and I appreciate the support that's been done. I think I read through some emails on the House Convention, and the question was, would the governor lose authority? And as we look at this, there probably would be diminishing of some authority because the ability to have a lawyer that does not follow the law. And I think that's probably the place. But I would encourage members of the committee to go back and read again, if I wasn't on the panel, to remind themselves of the factions of real danger and don't get into journeys. And I think that's what we have to kind of continue to look at. So it looks to me like if we elected somebody to write the whole law, observe discussion, probably in a bigger way than ever before. Because you have somebody that would be. As you had said, I think 3440 is the people's attorney. And the way it was kind of played in the Constitution of Nation, that he would be the governor's attorney if appointed. So, give me some background on how you contemplate what you would consider the people's attorney. And certainly, not popular vote, but how about on the administration of the law?
The political process would ferret out some pretty good candidates. The folks are demand that this is, I think, we have pretty high demands on our other constitutional office, not only the other government thing. Right now, you're crime built under Senator Confield. It would certainly remove any ambiguity in your time in the administration, the legal aspects of it, that a lot of reticence of the Senate on that bill, to the Attorney General's office, who would tie a lot of legal opinions and so forth, and make policy. And I think that's a responsibility to form a law. I mean, I would like to have the Attorney General more engaged in that. I think if they held up their responsibility, they would be having those open public discussions. This is one bill. I don't know how it would go one way or another, but we either get it more criticism or more weight. One way or another would be that we would have a definitive voice, and I think in some ways it would take out potential politics of the Attorney General reporting to the governor on what his position would be. On consumer protection, I think that's an area where I would like the Attorney General would be more vigorous on consumer protection. So, I would be that on issues with respect. We've had some unfortunate incidents in state government. I think a more aggressive attorney general who wasn't my primary responsibility might have brought things to the public more quickly than they did. And the case of the temptation the Secret Service agent has, or see a prime agent, but my first duty is to protect the president and his family. I never overlooked this part about the indiscretion or the other as long as it's not too serious. I mean, that those types of things, I think, you get rid of a lot of those when you have an independent law enforcement agency. I think we see at the national level, every once in a while, we've had a federal attorney general who might have made a political decision where they're at. And we don't have the capability to change that. I think there are a lot of initiatives that for political reasons, the Department of Law doesn't be involved in. But there's probably a strong public interest in an investigation. That just won't happen because they need the governor's permission.
Because of the time in history we find ourselves is privacy protection. And I think that would probably end up preventing the thought under consumer protection, as you said, Senator. Another thing is, during our founding history, decentralization of government has become both at the national level and the state level. And I think that it has worked to some degree in Alaska. But it looks to me like the Attorney General has become the government's attorney at this point. And I think that's one of the questions that we continue to ask is it becoming governance? And the government has to operate the administration. And the administration has a law group that works in every agency advising them on the law. And so that gives you a huge strength, I think, for administrative law, basically. But it does get people grounded on government rather than other people.
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm looking at. The Attorney General will do something that takes us three constitutional ratings to bicameral setups and then approval by the governor of the Attorney General to accomplish what gives us all the stats in one legal opinion on the Attorney General's opinion to accomplish. But you might have to work 10 years on it. That's a strong power to have for the governor's basically legal mandate. Just for background here, as the Constitution of Asian, whether he would be just a private attorney or if he would be in fact setting law by way of opinion. And it's more and more true that the opinions of the Attorney General is the procedure for the government to hold his own, basically. His opinion was as good as another one. If they determined to name ex post facto law. So, with this position suit within the executive branch, would they sit in our cabinet meetings? Have you given any thought on how exactly this would work?
It almost seems like you're very powerful from the general state, very powerful executive branch. It seems like Ron is setting up a big secret branch of government. We've got the Department of Law, which is a large amount of people that are constantly being federal lawsuits, not lawsuits. Do you have any sort of vision on how that would work?
It does create a it creates a third constitutional officer. Whether or not they're invited into the cabinet, I guess in our history of our attorney, we've already been a lieutenant governor, so some spend more time on one or the other. He's already a more embraced, I think, a savvy governor, but the attorney general. That's really what we think. The executive governor, actually, but
it is a new constitutional officer. There's a lot of federal rules that come in that specific branch of government, but it still is part of it's just a constitutional officer of the executive branch. Just that there is no more than a lieutenant governor isn't controlled, is not controlled by the governor. Lawsuits, do you envision working in the short amount of time with the executive governor and also sweeping in the attorney general? Do you envision both being able to go in and file suits or maybe one file a suit and another opposing that suit? How do you sort of visualize how that work?
Well, the attorney general would be the chief law enforcement officer, but I don't think this diminishes the governor's legal ability. He would have to use his own attorney to do that. But certainly, the legislature, we don't have our constitution of dedicated attorneys, the governor may seek outside, much like the legislature does without having a formal legal team with the executive. But this will have to be a constitutional amendment often requires some budgeting and even statutes and those laws. It's like the permanent funds managed by a series of statutes that set up the enabling legislation for the corporation that was conducted following the constitutional principles and all the way to the statutory legislation created manner of distributing hearings, legislation for the anarchy permanent fund units.
So,
Senator,
you're taking Senator
Brzezinski
number 12, and Senator
Wolski. Just go ahead, folks. Executive who currently oversees that Billy Gibbons, a high school graduate,
short. I'd stick that up against a law degree any day. But I think there's going to be a qualification voters now look at. Again, if you've got maybe even a 24-year-old student, as opposed to the requirement is a high belief. If you're the same age as that of the chief executive.
For the study committee to research those, wasn't there a time where Thomas Francis being considered in this program, but he didn't meet the requirements? And if so, what was the difference in license in the requirement?
The judicial council ruled him ineligible because he had not yet been out of state legislative service for 1 year.
Okay.
There's a requirement that the judge has to be a practicing lawyer for 7 years. And he had his law license coming up and everything. They found that he had been effectively practicing law for 7 years and 5 years.
Okay.
And so they didn't want to say that he had been practicing law. They were
making
the law.
Because I remember, that's what I want to bring up on this point, which is that, you could say both ways, but that was one that was a little absurd.
And I'm sure these arguments have come up in previous iterations, and we can back in and go around the other committees and the other body. There were discussions about the superior court judge requirements and about the other sides. I mean, those types of qualifications, I'm not sure who we would bar them from serving. If you have two standards of public qualifications, then this is the people's choice. It's the people's lawyer. I guess the people should be able to hire their own lawyer. Just full disclosure of what the qualifications are. If people hire them now, I don't know if they just make sure they buy a phone call sometimes.
So,
I think
that needs a little
question. If you're at this point, the Attorney General goes through the Social Security Alert Center. Consent, basically, or non-consent, which we have the right to say no, and as an example, on the other hand, if somebody who was going to have a constitutional office in Alaska and put themselves out and they were not qualified, I think that would be even a greater process than we have presently now. So I think what we do here is we do so there are qualifications, and you try to get deference from others as you can. And in the constitutional office, our qualifications are together, though we may disagree with what the people have put forward many times I have. The qualifications have been very well vetted in the public. So this is the confidence in the people. All the confidence that sometimes arose with me is just the presentation of the voting population. It's just the flow as it is, just tells me. But the other thing is, people are more involved in the decisions of government, and they may not get involved in that. So, to me, I think the vetting process and qualification right now is led by one man, the governor, and one bodies or actually there is no body in the legislature. This would be the most broader thing I think.
So there are some of us here to get things in the
legislature. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious, I know some states already elect an attorney general. Sure. 23 states elect do have their alternative selection Tennessee Supreme Court changed it, I believe it's many of the wrong requirements on that, but the Northeast states and the legislature, I think, elects. And then five states, Alaska, Hawaii, New Jersey, maybe Wyoming, I can't remember the other off the top of my head, the chief executive appoints.
Are there any amendments to come up for the committee? Senator Wilbur, who can see? Okay.
make the Attorney General work into a nonpartisan looking.
The conceptual amendment. Okay, and there is an objection to the amendment. Speaking to that objection, Senator Hoffman?
I think the idea that nonpartisan somehow means simply a philosophical discussion out of debate. I've seen enough nonpartisan, that's just not true. The idea that somehow partisanship equals polarization, I get that part. I don't mind people identifying with a particular group of people. I think that the governor does that. I think the legislature does that. I think the Missouri governor does that. I think that having an alignment of interest would be important. I understand that somehow, I don't think that if you're somehow trying to align it on or all political, and that's just not the case. In cases, our whole judicial system creates under being a fight system that's supposed to be nonpartisan, and yet they can have some very strong held views that need to push on, I think. So I think giving people the opportunity to identify as the other constitutional officer, I think is appropriate.
Other discussion?
Yeah, just I think people are tired of party politics. The last year in the country, I think we should be doing anything we can, but I think we can put in politics out of elections. I think we have an opportunity to get this bill moves forward to create a different position, a position in our Constitution that virtually includes a local party. I think most Alaskans are affiliated with a political party. Clearly, most Alaskans are affiliated with a political party. And so, if the idea is to make this less political, essentially less political, not only in the nonpartisan position, that just takes some necessity. I think most Alaskans would agree with that.
Thank you. Excellent.
I did not say party. You can pick a philosophy that flies under several banners. And it doesn't have to be party driven. A lot of you pick it up, but just because I'm a Republican doesn't mean a party. Because it doesn't support me. Quite often that's just not true. I think that in general, the party doesn't have to operate for the zero. So I operate that. I run for office, need to be here for the input. Thanks very much for seeing this letter. The weakness of it. If this party is a big party, I just said you could pick the label that you want to run under and associate with me on the first name of this party corporate. Just a question for the sponsor. I don't know what the situation is. Maybe it's by nonpartisan. You're thinking that there wouldn't be any. Primary, is that the only thing that chooses to run for being Attorney General? Is that a general election? I'm just looking for more details.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the vision is to definitely really be a primary in order to work on the board and be on the general election. And you want to identify the primary political party, where you identify as a Republican, Democrat, Green, Liberal, Libertarian, whatever. It was said to be your name and your person's name, and then the voters would be more likely to discover what that person really means instead of what they think that political party stands for. I think it's will give the voters the opportunity to vote and really try to discover what each individual is in for his position. This is going to be a very powerful position, and it should be based on what political party you are.
You said, you're not going to see a primary type. I might be likely to support if there were some kind of primary unity with nonpartisan. I might live out it. I like the word menagerie, because it just sort of illustrates what you might have if you had 15 people on a ticket where a couple of really highly qualified top runners might be washed out by a few votes here and there of the local folks, and you might not end up with a healthy result. It's a very important position, as you say, I'm worried about that. It would take more thought for me to support that. If I knew a system that might result in narrowing the field to perhaps
two or three, maybe four qualified folks that would be best for the state in either a general position, and it would be likely to move that way.
I mean, it is a nonpartisan nature to worry about the mechanics.
Typical things. Our design discussion about Amendment 10, I was trying to push the timeline a little bit here and recognizing that this is the failure of conceptual amendments. Sometimes we have failure of things. So, in light of the importance of it and so forth, then we'll go ahead and move the conversation until Wednesday. Senator Pompeo, would like to make a point on that.
I think
Long term, how many do you know, he or she, 24 attorneys here since the status. So those are my concerns, and I know if you know how to put them to a balance, I would vote no.
Thank you, Ms. Barr, for your testimony. And I'm going to go ahead and set Senator Resolution 112 to the side. And now we'll go ahead and bring up the CS District Number 164 Family Motions in her program.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I move that we have for our working document CS District Number 164, 29-GS2958-H in the hotel.
Is there an objection to that motion as a working document? Okay, hearing and seeing none, I'll go ahead and ask Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Michigan, Brian Brooks, to come forward and tell us about the bill.
Thank you for having me, Deputy Commissioner, for the fishing meeting. I appreciate the time of the committee today to consider SB-164. Actually, all four of the members present have already heard a little bit about SB-164 and the Senate Resources Committee. On the line today, I have Governor Testing, Major Testing, for public safety as a recovery prisoner, and Secretary Stale from the National Wildlife Conservation, and Assistant AG, John Peterson. So, the purpose of the legislation is to provide the last of all the troopers the ability to issue practical citations, among other things, similar to that for driver's license. The bill would prevent a person from receiving a sport fishing hunter or trapping license in Alaska for privileges and then suspend or revoke them on their state. The bill increases restitution for animals harvested illegally. It also standardizes penalties for offenses and provides an additional tool for the U.S. wildlife troopers in charging wildlife fisheries and habitat crimes. I allow some of those offenses to be reduced violations. And finally, the bill allows for the display of a license in the electronic format to affect some of our modernization efforts in the Michigan licensing program. There are a number of changes are identified in the last committee as it been incorporated in the current substitute, all budget again. We had a couple of typographic errors that were corrected. We removed the committee members may remember some of the discussion on the challenges of having tag and permit included, and we've removed that so that only a license is correctable and not a tag or permit. We've also added a section that our major chairman can talk about that would that the court would not be able to order restitution if the defendant voluntarily turned himself to that sort of something that the ADD was addressing. And we also removed the court from the bill. There's well the parent presentation is really the Department of Public Safety and the court was very much in agreement with that change is going to remove the Court Rule 5A-4 from the back of the bill. So there's a summary of the changes. I don't know what the pleasure of the committee is. Section 1 else is printed on the door, but we're happy to do that again for you. Or to set your questions, so I'll be happy to proceed.
Maybe what we can do is we can ask Major Chastain the things that you wanted to add on the changes at this point, and then I can talk to the committee again. I'm proud to see you. Major Chastain, was there anything you wanted to add to the last time, Mr. Wilson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm with the committee. Major Chastain, for the record, I'm the Deputy Director for the Alaska Mounted Troopers. There's a couple other sections that have been changed. There's the registry amount that has been increased. That primarily just comes into changes in the current Section 18, which I believe Mr. Harrison will talk about more shortly. I'm glad to address those issues if you like, and then go over what the goal is by adding the Section 18 language.
Okay, good. The Section 18 language is going to be important, and then other advice, and you talk to us a little bit about the methodology. Rather than having the courts handle just how we think that would work through
Office of the elected presiding agency in person, and they must give
restaurants is probably be pretty burdensome for a lot of people. Is it a big deal to allow someone to mail a copy of their documents they don't want to scan and email in?
The current process where someone brings their citation in requires that the citation themselves be stamped with a special stamp that each of the system two provinces have. And when that is sent to the court, it tells the court that it's been officially corrected and that they should not pursue any action on that citation.
If that's the way you have to do it, then I'll understand that, but I just think this is, someone has a valid license, or for whatever reason, it's not there, or it gets wet, you can't read it. It just seems a little burdensome. Is it able to make some burdensome for some people throughout the state to do this? And I'm just wondering if all the technological advances we have, and how can it be done in some way that someone can mail that document or email it, scan it,
The process for other citations to be corrected in an established process in the court system. There is likely a way for all correctable citations to go through the process of either mailing in or having some sort of electronic checkoff. At this point, we don't have that in place.
Since a permit is required for personal use, I think on the record before we talked about sport or personal use fishing on number one, because you can't personal use without a permit, and it's not something you can use later because you have to record and catch. So there's a line more detail than it would have to see sport or personal use fishing. It's not set the other departments on that time.
Thank you.
talked about that a little bit in the last community referral. And I've got a suicide agenda. Is that something you would anticipate having an immediate action on? For example, we talked about even placing a stamp in in order to the person may not hesitate at a institution. Do you have a process that you think they need to implement, or is this language we have on creating a situation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We believe in conversation with the Department of Law that this will provide judges it'll basically prohibit the judge from imposing restitution on someone voluntarily in terms of consulting. And so if it prevents in court the person's case until the judge this person voluntarily done themselves in, and as a result, the judge will be prepared to award restitution in the case.
Sorry, did you have another question? Now we turn the chair back over to the chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Madam Chair. Section 18, and that was one of the things I brought up as well. I had the discussion and resources, I believe it was. I talked about the use of general in charge of institution and wanted that in statute. And the discussion at the time is to largely focused on hunting. But we also talked about sport fishing, sport or personal use fishing, where a person counts their creel and realizes they've got 7 on by, and instead of wasting the fish, throws themselves in. Or I'm a case I personally use, where if you really think this, I don't trust me, and the fish, you don't want to dispose of the extra fish, you'd rather either turn it in and let the department know about it and perhaps donate it to a food bank or something. The fourth area that I was interested in, I talked about it going right down the commercial fishery, where some commercial fishery out there might want to gear to try to make some split. I'd rather that they probably serve the fish and notify the department in advance that they were moving the line, and that's not restitution. So that's more relating from restitution to fines. How do we deal with those issues? I was from people that turn themselves in and do the right thing with the fish or game. This is largely isolating game only when it doesn't deal with the fishing violations.
So I'll refer to the last point first, with fishing violations. I am not aware throughout my career of any legal self-determining commercial fishing violation, other than when someone calls and says that they've had a chemical and something's wrong. And in that situation, I am confident that we treat them fairly, especially if we're on the fishing ground and we're able to contact them and actually see if they have a mechanical issue. In those situations, we do extremely as fairly as we possibly can. The restitution amounts, at least the restitution for commercial fishing, is not in our government when we're looking at here. There is a situation where the fish are caught illegally, that the fish are sold to a processor, and then the fish are held in a, the proceeds are held in an account.
Okay. So I'm only talking about mechanical. I can't think of another reason to deal with the line if it were strict in the law. I'm only talking about mechanical, but if we're not expecting a defendant to pay restitution to the state for the take of an animal because they want that animal harvested and on the hunting grounds, well, we might want to do the same thing for sport fishing and commercial fishing out of one of the states or the states on the fishing grounds. And I would say that because you say that you felt that it's important for it to be codified where a judge would not be able to hospital institution during the night violation, why would we want to qualify the same? And when I think about commercial fishing, I'm not thinking about the first event after that. You start to see a trend. And I think the same thing would be with sport fishing as well.
In sport fishing and commercial fishing, there is a restriction amount currently, so even if that was codified in the same section, there would be no reference to a restitution for those things. In a case similar case of sport fishing or some of them where there are limits in sockeye salmon, there is, under the bail schedule, there is, several years ago, was put in place a flat fine, which establishes a fine for the offense, and an additional amount for each fish over their limit. So we have the ability to charge that as a flat fine plus what you might call restitution for each additional fish taken illegally. Does that answer your question?
I understand the difference, which is why I also talked about fines versus restitution. In trying to encourage the best behavior for someone making a not counting well or a mechanical in the commercial fishery, it seems that if we want the animals harvested and brought to a place where they could be used. So the question of when you think about in the commercial fishery, do we want those fish harvested? Certainly the commercial fishermen should not have a value in those fish. But if someone has a mechanical and calls you to harvest a fish and says, hey, I've got 2 shovels on and they took me out of the water and they keep fish here, where do I deliver them? So it's safe to collect their restitution, if you will. Seems like that would encourage better behavior than sort of trying to pick quickly and get away with it, if you know what I mean.
It's mostly process right now and establishing how that works. And policy. There is no restitution on a commercial fish situation like that other than the fish themselves. That restitution amount is each of the states and of course designed what happens to those fish. So I agree with you that it could be a little clearer. I don't know conceptually how that would look.
Section 18, it talks about the salvage portions, and so the question is generally whether all salvage portions get all put in or can that salvage skull as a people. Does that include their paws and their gallbladders, for example, or is it kind of trafficked and just overextended a lot sometimes?
In a situation where someone takes and wriggles loose, we're certainly not going to record it and bring that contestant and the tournament that happened to on the field. So, in the case of a bear, we would certainly investigate the case and we believe that if the non-resident was covered by the cell parts, we would obviously not charge them with a violation.
Is there a problem with trafficking of those particular gallbladders and gallbladders, which are being killed for extremely many animals? Is that a problem? I'll ask it again. I'm not sure the sign was there because it protects us from that.
Yeah, sure. I'll take the latter part of the statement first. There are a dozen or so other regulations of statute that require salvage of all damaged and electrical parts. There are set out one game and other statutes that govern not listing at all. So I feel very comfortable that we're protected by the language that's here with the other regulations in your place. To your first question about spare parts, not nearly as bad as it has been in the past. And the reason for that is spare parts, particularly gallbladders, are used for medicinal purposes. And there are other drugs that are available now that have taken the place of that. Although penetrating spare parts is still an international issue and still a problem in a lot of countries, there is still the idea that there is a curing out there for violence, things like for clinical care, for instance. One of the theories in the world that has animals that can be taken for those purposes. And so the idea that people are still treating those occurs, but not nearly as bad as in the 90s.
I talked earlier about the first time of offense, it's in question section 18. Where's that little about section 18? And full support it the first time. But it was a good treaty, and I don't know what the 50 is challenged, right? It could create a situation where a hunter is willing to take the chance to place on a mechanical means and deliver on the meat. To the Department of Air Salvage Parts without an addition of any first time or once every 5 years or something. You can't probably need any incentive for a hunter to be extra vehicle. It could happen to anyone, to kind of a 50 inch issue, but how do you feel that we would deal with that? Do you agree with my concern?
Good chance, Senator McKinney. So there is a lot of discussion about that particular issue. As we work through this, we discussed the ability, the most important thing, the ability for the volunteer person or the staff agency to have some sort of flexibility in charging, because every scenario is very different, and I think that's what you're getting at, is that there are, it may be the first time offense, or maybe the person has a history of violent violations, and because of that, we have to have flexibility in charging. And so, as we examine this, we talked about doing it just for the first time. We also talked about saying that if it was time, and the court and make it mandatory. But I can tell you that violation of offense is typically charged on a first time occurrence only, and that is the discretion of the district attorney's office or the charging agency. There are lots of reasons why the first time offense may not be charged as a violation. And here's an example. So typically we receive phone calls from people in the field with the availability of cell phones. We get phone calls where someone is actually sitting on the outside watching a violation occur. And when that happens, we may get multiple phone calls that are watching the person commit a violation. In that scenario, because of the call for service, we have to go and investigate. And when we contact that person in the field who's kicking the animal, they may tell us that to turn themselves in, and we have to investigate that to determine if that's in fact the truth. But because we receive a call for service, oftentimes those cases get treated differently than violations. So people want to put a scenario that ties their hands with the first violation, every time being a violation, and so because of that, we want to call in.
So, okay, in line 12, when we're talking about penalties and violations, it says that they may be ordered by the court to pay restitution. But line 27 essentially says that they may not be ordered to pay restitution if it's voluntary and immediate report. Is there another way that you can charge the taking of an animal legally under that violation?
In the case of the taking, there is two versions. So, all these crimes default to a misdemeanor offense. We have the ability under RA-C-92 and regulations adopted to charge those as violations. So, typically, we have the ability to reduce to a strict liability violation, which is a maximum of $500. And then we charge that as a violation offense instead of a misdemeanor. In the question that you had under 112, this definition of the statute deals with misdemeanor offenses, so the court may up to that amount of restitution for misdemeanor offenses. And so today we're saying when it's turned into a violation, the court cannot impose restitution.
I assure Senator Wojcicki's concern for this section because it's a mandatory section. You're saying, and I keep talking about discretionary, but I'm having this event where it says the defendant may not be ordered to pay restitution. And I think Senator Wojcicki's concern is about that. You can easily envision a certain person without, and right now they're being extraordinarily careful. This passes the compliant air free shot, and I can take that chance if I made a mistake at this point and not even before. And the other thing that concerns me is this voluntarily and immediately reporting it. People are out there, out in the world, there's a lot of people don't carry cell phones. But voluntary and immediately report could be days later, potentially. They could have acted so well up and be driving down the highway back to their home. And they have to report the moment they have cell reception. The person gives them the phone, obviously, until I get close to my house. There's no activities in it. I just got to flee on these cells. I just have some concerns here. Yeah, this is weird.
Mr. Chair, I just want to ask very briefly around the penalty facility part of the line. I think it's so important because the important thing to remember is it is the district attorney's office and the standing agency's discretion to decide what to charge in a violation. So we believe that something is actually a foul other than they legitimately turn themselves in, then we will charge them as a misdemeanor offense and restitution can be applied by the court. But they're basically as for the right there to go.
Mr. Peterson, I'm following the line of discussion between Senator Wojcicki and Major Justy.
Thank you, Chair, Senator Wojcicki. This is a musician from the Department of Homeland Security. This person is actually 18. This is not until somebody who deserves to stand trial for a misdemeanor. They have simply because they were not able to get restitution or the correct order that they did not have restitution. We're talking about here is a state person who voluntarily turned themselves in, and the language for you is they're voluntarily and immediately turned themselves in. Then there's not even an order to pay restitution in front of these states. However, if it was something that they did year after year, or for other reasons, they're not in the law, decided to do it in the new year, then we're looking at an annual fine that they have not in front of them. Loss of legal privileges for an extended period of time. We're looking at $10,000 fine for offense. We're looking at a more general range of penalties that are much more substantial than mere restitution. Now, restitution is important, very important, and I've added numbers here in Section 15, wherever they are. But I think that it just as you know, that might be missing the greater point that. And then he does the entire design, and they're going to see it like 30 inch moves and say, well, that one was 50. They're not getting off. Or, you know, they're not like
You're saying you have the ability to go ahead and pass on one and prosecute someone with a misdemeanor, but that's discretionary. And I've always had concerns about leaving too much discretion to prosecutors. I've always had that concern, as long as I've been on this committee. And I understand this is a balancing test that I entered, and it's a hard one. And I'm just sort of wrestling with all these different things that are out there. And these are not only things that are strange, but a lot of discussions. I think that's all they want to see here, but they don't understand what the laws are. So, just this real government doesn't trust me.
Yes,
I'm a little busy. Seeing the chicken. You get confused a lot for some reason. I'm more satisfied with the discussion. So, if I hear you correctly, if a dad that I was an 18-year-old or 19-year-old, what they think is a 50-inch plus animal, and dad says, then I'm on a second to let me get another one. 18-year-old squeezes the trigger, and they know the next 48, they turn themselves in. And likely to be charged as a violation of liking not to be, which was my model. That was the case where I hope for one timer, and likely not asked or the investigation. But what you're telling me is that you're more likely for that same family the next year that says once, you're more likely to charge with a misdemeanor and ask him. Requiring this goes to the restitution, and you're saying that the prosecutor would likely go that way. So just if you can't hear it, because I don't recall. Yes, sir.
Thank you, Senator Kidney. This is my question. I'm correct. That is exactly how things happen right now, and have been happening for quite a few years. Charging for the violation of that. They receive a $200 citation. The education occurs at the time of the citation, although they feel bad for what they did, which is why they turn themselves in to begin with. And all those things are solved. It's very rare that we get a person who's turned in to violate the end in any type of situation. And that's because they get more.
Okay, and then I follow up, which I think goes to Senator Wilkinson's concern, is it the law, not the law to be, but it does the QEO kinds of things, where someone might put pressure on a prosecutor, then has a huge case load, might say, it's easier for one more violation, it might only have been up to me, and I think that's part of the concern, but, if your experience has been that the department has been fairly pure in the prosecution of these cases, I think I'm going to let it go right now, despite the hearing statement about your experience.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank
you for having this decision. There was a discussion about how you make a first time, just as it occurs, this would be applied.
Thank you.